2. Zov had lived 60 years, Parth 20. But she seemed, that cold afternoon in the long fields, old in a way no man could be old, ageless. She had no comfort from ideas of ultimate star-spanning triumph or the prevalence of truth. Her father's prophetic gift in her was only lack of illusion. She knew Falk was going. She said only, "You won't come back." "I will come back, Parth." She held him in her arms, but she did not listen to his promise. He tried to bespeak her, though he had little skill in telepathic communication. The only listener in the house was blind Kretion. None of them was adept at the nonverbal communication, mind speech. The techniques of learning mind speech had not been lost, but they were little practiced. The great virtue of that most intense and perfect form of communication had become its peril for men. Mind speech between two intelligences could be incoherent or insane, and could, of course, involve error, misbelief, but it could not be misused. Between thought and spoken word is a gap where intention can enter, the symbol be twisted aside, and the lie come to be. Between thought and sent thought is no gap. They are one act. There is no room for the lie. In the late years of the League, the tales and fragmentary records Falk had studied seemed to show the use of mind speech had been widespread and the telepathic skills very highly developed. It was a skill Earth had come to late, learning its techniques from some other race. The Last Art, one book called it. There were hints of troubles and upheavals in the government of the League of All Worlds, rising perhaps from that prevalence of a form of communication that precluded lying. But all that was vague and half-legendary, like all man's history. Certainly since the coming of the Xing and the downfall of the League, the scattered community of man had mistrusted trust and used the spoken word. A free man can speak freely, but a slave or fugitive must be able to hide truth and lie. So Falk had learned in Zov's house, and so it was that he had had little practice in the attunement of minds. But he tried now to bespeak Parth so she would know he was not lying. "Believe me, Parth, I will come back to you." But she wouldn't hear. "No, I won't mind speak," she said aloud. "Then you're keeping your thoughts from me." "Yes, I am. Why should I give you my grief? What's the good of truth? If you had lied to me yesterday, I'd still believe that you were only going to Rancifel and would be back home in a 10-night. Then I'd still have 10 days and nights. Now I have nothing left, not a day, not an hour. It's all taken, all over. What good is truth? Parth, will you wait for me 1 year?" "No, only a year. A year and a day. And you'll return riding a silver steed to carry me to your kingdom and make me its queen. No, I won't wait for you, Falk. Why must I wait for a man who will be lying dead in the forest, or shot by wanderers out on the prairie, or brainless in the city of the Xing, or gone off 100 years to another star? What should I wait for? You needn't think I'll take another man. I won't. I'll stay here in my father's house. I'll dye black thread and weave black cloth to wear. Black to wear and black to dye in, but I won't wait for anyone or anything. Never." "I had no right to ask you," he said with the humility of pain. And she cried, "Oh, Falk, I don't reproach you." They were sitting together on the slight slope above the long field. Goats and sheep grazed over the mile of fenced pasture between them and the forest. Yearling colts pranced and tagged around the shaggy mares. A gray November wind blew. Their hands lay together. Parth touched the gold ring on his left hand.
"A ring is a thing given," she said. "Sometimes I've thought,
have you, that you may have had a wife? Think, if she was waiting for you. She shivered. What of it? He said. What do I care about what may have been, what I was? Why should I go from here? All that I am now is yours, Parth, came from you, your gift. It was freely given, the girl said in tears. Take it and go. Go on. They held each other, and neither would break free. The house lay far behind hoar black trunks and intertangling leafless branches. The trees closed in behind the trail. The day was gray and cool, silent except for the drone of wind through branches, a meaningless whisper without locality that never ceased. Metok led the way, setting a long, easy pace. Falk followed, and young Thuro came last. They were all three dressed light and warm in hooded shirt and breeches of an unwoven stuff called winter cloth, over which no coat was needed even in snow. Each carried a light backpack of gifts and trade goods, sleeping bag, enough dried concentrated food to see him through a month's blizzard. Buckeye, who had never left the house of her birth, had a great fear of perils and delays in the forest and had supplied their packs accordingly. Each wore a laser beam gun, and Falk carried some extras, another pound or two of food, medicines, compass, a second gun, a change of clothing, a coil of rope. A little book given him 2 years ago by Zov, amounting in all to about 15 pounds of stuff, his earthly possessions. Easy and tireless, Metok loped on ahead, and 10 yards or so behind he followed, and after him came Thuro. They went lightly, with little sound, and behind them the trees gathered motionless over the faint, leaf-strewn trail. They would come to Rancifel on the third day. At evening of the second day they were in country different from that around Zove's house. The forest was more open, the ground broken. Gray glades lay along hillsides above brush-choked streams. They made camp in one of these open places, on a south-facing slope, for the north wind was blowing stronger with a hint of winter in it. Thuro brought armloads of dry wood while the other two cleared away the gray grass and piled up a rough hearth of stones. As they worked, Metok said, "We crossed a divide this afternoon. The stream down there runs west, to the inland river, finally." Falk straightened up and looked westward, but the low hills rose up soon, and the low sky closed down, leaving no distant view. "Metok," he said, "I've been thinking there's no point in my going on to Rancifel. I may as well be on my way. There seemed to be a trail leading west along the big stream we crossed this afternoon. I'll go back and follow it." Metok glanced up. He did not mind speak, but his thought was plain enough. "Are you thinking of running back home?" Falk did use mind speech for his reply. "No, damn it, I'm not." "I'm sorry," the elder brother said aloud in his grim, scrupulous way. He had not tried to hide the fact that he was glad to see Falk go. To Metok, nothing mattered much but the safety of the house. Any stranger was a threat, even the stranger he had known for 5 years, his hunting companion and his sister's lover. But he went on. "They'll make you welcome at Rancifel. Why not start from there?" "Why not from here?" "Your choice." Metok worked the last rock into place, and Falk began to build up the fire. "If that was a trail we crossed, I don't know where it comes from or goes. Early tomorrow we'll cross a real path, the old Hirand Road. Hirand House was a long way west, a week on foot at least. Nobody's gone there for 60 or 70 years, I don't know why. But the trail was still plain last time I came this way. The other might be an animal track and lead you straying or leave you in a swamp." "All right, I'll try the Hirand Road." There was a pause, then Metok asked, "Why are you going west?" "Because S. Touch is in the West. The name seldom spoken sounded flat and strange out here under the sky. Thurow, coming up with an armload of wood, glanced around uneasily. Metok asked nothing more. That night on the hillside by the campfire was Falk's last with those who were to him his brothers, his own people. Next morning they were on the trail again a little after sunrise, and long before noon they came to a wide, overgrown trace leading to the left off the path to Rancifel. There was a kind of gateway to it made by two great pines. It was dark and still under their boughs where they stopped. "Come back to us, guest and brother," young Thurow said, troubled even in his bridegroom's self-absorption by the look of that dark, vague way Falk would be taking. Metok said only, "Give me your water flask, will you?" and in exchange gave Falk his own flask of chased silver. Then they parted, they going north, and he west. After he had walked a while, Falk stopped and looked back. The others were out of sight. The Rancifel trail was already hidden behind the young trees and brush that overgrew the Hirund Road. The road looked as though it was used, if infrequently, but had not been kept up or cleared for many years. Around Falk, nothing was visible but the forest, the wilderness. He stood alone under the shadows of the endless trees. The ground was soft with the fall of a thousand years. The great trees, pines and hemlocks, made the air dark and quiet. A fleck or two of sleet danced in the dying wind. Falk eased the strap of his pack a bit and went on. By nightfall, it seemed to him that he had been gone from the house for a long, long time, that it was immeasurably far behind him, that he had always been alone. His days were all the same. Gray winter light, a wind blowing, forest-clad hills and valleys, long slopes, brush-hidden streams, swampy lowlands. Though badly overgrown, the Hirund Road was easy to follow, for it led in long straight shafts or long easy curves, avoiding the bogs and the heights. In the hills, Falk realized it followed the course of some great ancient highway, for its way had been cut right through the hills, and 2,000 years had not effaced it wholly. But the trees grew on it, and beside it, and all about it, pine and hemlock, vast holly thickets on the slopes, endless stands of beech, oak, hickory, alder, ash, elm, all overtopped and crowned by the lordly chestnuts, only now losing their last dark yellow leaves, dropping their fat brown burrs along the path. At night he cooked the squirrel or rabbit or wild hen he had bagged from among the infinity of little game that scurried and flitted here in the kingdom of the trees. He gathered beechnuts and walnuts, roasted the chestnuts on his campfire coals. But the nights were bad. There were two evil dreams that followed him each day and always caught up with him by midnight. One was of being stealthily pursued in the darkness by a person he could never see. The other was worse. He dreamed that he had forgotten to bring something with him, something important, essential, without which he would be lost. From this dream he woke and knew that it was true. He was lost. It was himself he had forgotten. He would build up his fire then, if it was not raining, and would crouch beside it, too sleepy and dream-bemused to take up the book he carried, the old canon, and seek comfort in the words which declared that when all ways are lost, the way lies clear. A man all alone is a miserable thing, and he knew he was not even a man, but at best a kind of half-being, trying to find his wholeness by setting out aimlessly to cross a continent under uninterested stars. The days were all the same, but they were a relief after the nights. He was still keeping count of their number, and it was on the 11th day from the crossroads, the 13th of his journey, that he came to the end of the Herend Road. There had been a clearing once. He found a way through great tracts of wild bramble and second-growth birch thickets to four crumbling black towers that stuck high up out of the brambles and vines and mummied thistles, the chimneys of a fallen house. Herend was nothing now, a name. The road ended at the ruin. He stayed around the fallen place a couple of hours, kept there simply by the bleak hint of human presence. He turned up a few fragments of rusty machinery, bits of broken pottery which outlive even men's bones, a scrap of rotted cloth which fell to dust in his hands. At last he pulled himself together and looked for a trail leading west out of the clearing. He came across a strange thing, a field a half-mile square covered perfectly level and smooth with some glassy substance, dark violet-colored, unflawed. Earth was creeping over its edges, and leaves and branches had scurfed it over, but it was unbroken, unscratched. It was as if the great level space had been flooded with melted amethyst. What had it been? A launching field for some unimaginable vehicle? A mirror with which to signal other worlds? The basis of a force field? Whatever it was, it had brought doom on Herend. It had been a greater work than the Shing permitted men to undertake. Falk went on past it and entered the forest, following no path now. These were clean woods of stately, wide-aisled, deciduous trees. He went on at a good pace the rest of that day and the next morning. The country was growing hilly again, the ridges all running north-south across his way, and around noon, heading for what looked from one ridge like the low point of the next, he became embroiled in a marshy valley full of streams. He searched for fords, floundered in boggy water meadows, all in a cold, heavy rain. Finally, as he found a way up out of the gloomy valley, the weather began to break up, and as he climbed the ridge, the sun came out ahead of him under the clouds and sent a wintry glory raying down among the naked branches, brightening them and the great trunks and the ground with wet gold. That cheered him. He went on sturdily, figuring to walk till day's end before he camped. Everything was bright now and utterly silent, except for the drip of rain from twig ends and the far-off wistful whistle of a chickadee. Then he heard, as in his dream, the steps that followed behind him to his left. A fallen oak that had been an obstacle became, in one startled moment, a defense. He dropped down behind it, and with drawn gun spoke aloud, "Come on out!" For a long time, nothing moved. "Come out!" Falk said with the mind speech, then closed to reception, for he was afraid to receive. He had a sense of strangeness. There was a faint, rank odor on the wind. A wild boar walked out of the trees, crossed his tracks, and stopped to snuff the ground. A grotesque, magnificent pig with powerful shoulders, razor back, trim, quick, filthy legs, over snout and tusk and bristle, little bright eyes looked up at Falk.
"Man, the creature said, snuffling.
Falk's tense muscles jumped, and his hand tightened on the grip of his laser pistol. He did not shoot. A wounded boar was hideously quick and dangerous. He crouched there, absolutely still.
"Man, man," said the wild pig, the voice thick and flat from the scarred snout. "Think to me. Think to me. Words are hard for me."
Falk's hand on the pistol shook now. Suddenly he spoke aloud.
"Don't speak, then. I will not mind speak. Go on. Go your pig's way. Man, bespeak me. Go, or I will shoot. Falk stood up, his gun pointing steadily. The little bright hog eyes watched the gun. It is wrong to take life, said the pig. Falk had got his wits back, and this time made no answer, sure that the beast understood no words. He moved the gun a little, recentered its aim, and said, Go. The boar dropped its head, hesitated. Then, with incredible swiftness, as if released by a cord breaking, it turned and ran the way it had come. Falk stood still a while, and when he turned and went on, he kept his gun ready in his hand. His hand shook again a little. There were old tales of beasts that spoke, but the people of Zove's house had thought them only tales. He felt a brief nausea, and an equally brief wish to laugh out loud. Parth, he whispered, for he had to talk to somebody. I just had a lesson in ethics from a wild pig. Oh, Parth, will I ever get out of the forest? Does it ever end? He worked his way on up the steepening, brushy slopes of the ridge. At the top, the woods thinned out, and through the trees he saw sunlight and the sky. A few paces more, and he was out from under the branches, on the rim of a green slope that dropped down to a sweep of orchards and ploughlands, and at last to a wide, clear river. On the far side of the river, a herd of 50 or more cattle grazed in a long-fenced meadow, above which hayfields and orchards rose, steepening towards the tree-rimmed western ridge. A short way south of where Falk stood, the river turned a little around a low knoll, over the shoulder of which, gilt by the low late sun, rose the red chimneys of a house. It looked like a piece of some other golden age caught in that valley, and overlooked by the passing centuries, preserved from the great wild disorder of the desolate forest. Haven, companionship, and above all, order, the work of man. A kind of weakness of relief filled Falk at the sight of a wisp of smoke rising from those red chimneys, a hearth fire. He ran down the long hillside and through the lowest orchard to a path that wandered along beside the riverbank among scrub alder and golden willows. No living thing was to be seen except the red-brown cattle grazing across the water. The silence of peace filled the wintry, sunlit valley. Slowing his pace, he walked between kitchen gardens to the nearest door of the house. As he came around the knoll, the place rose up before him, walls of ruddy brick and stone reflecting in the quickened water where the river curved. He stopped, a little daunted, thinking he had best hail the house aloud before he went any farther. A movement in an open window just above the deep doorway caught his eye. As he stood half-hesitant, looking up, he felt a sudden deep, thin pain sear through his chest just below the breastbone. He staggered and then dropped, doubling up like a swatted spider. The pain had been only for an instant. He did not lose consciousness, but he could not move or speak. People were around him. He could see them dimly through waves of non-seeing, but could not hear any voices. It was as if he had gone deaf and his body was entirely numb. He struggled to think through this deprivation of the senses. He was being carried somewhere and could not feel the hands that carried him. A horrible giddiness overwhelmed him, and when it passed, he had lost all control of his thoughts, which raced and babbled and chattered. Voices began to gabble and drone inside his mind, though the world drifted and ebbed dim and silent about him. Who are you? Are you? Where do you come from, Falk? Going where? Going are you? I don't know. Are you a man? West going? I don't know. Where the way? Eyes, a man, not a man. Waves and echoes and flights of words like sparrows. Demands, replies, narrowing, overlapping, lapping, crying, dying away to a gray silence. A surface of darkness lay before his eyes. An edge of light lay along it. A table. The edge of a table, lamp-lit in a dark room. He began to see, to feel. He was in a chair, in a dark room, by a long table on which a lamp stood. He was tied into the chair. He could feel the cord cut into the muscles of his chest and arms as he moved a little. Movement. A man sprang into existence at his left, another at his right. They were sitting, like him, drawn up to the table. They leaned forward and spoke to each other across him. Their voices sounded as if they came from behind high walls a great way off, and he could not understand the words. He shivered with cold. With the sensation of cold, he came more closely in touch with the world and began to regain control of his mind. His hearing was clearer. His tongue was loose. He said something which was meant to be, "What did you do to me?" There was no answer, but presently the man on his left stuck his face quite close to Falk's and said loudly, "Why did you come here?" Falk heard the words. After a moment, he understood them. After another moment, he answered, "For refuge. The night." "Refuge from what?"
"Forest. Alone."
He was more and more penetrated with cold. He managed to get his heavy, clumsy hands up a little, trying to button his shirt. Below the straps that bound him in the chair, just below his breastbone, was a little painful spot.
"Keep your hands down," the man on his right said out of the shadows. "It's more than programming, Argerd. No hypnotic block could stand up to Penton that way."
The one on his left, slab-faced and quick-eyed, a big man, answered in a weak, sibilant voice,
"You can't say that. What do we know about their tricks? Anyhow, how can you estimate his resistance? What is he? You, Falk, where is this place you came from, Zove's house?"
"East. I left..." The number would not come to mind. 14 days ago, I think.
How did they know the name of his house, his name? He was getting his wits back now, and did not wonder very long. He had hunted deer with Metok, using hypodermic darts which could make even a scratch wound a kill. The dart that had felled him, or a later injection when he was helpless, had been some drug which must relax both the learned control and the primitive unconscious block of the telepathic centers of the brain, leaving him open to paraverbal questioning. They had ransacked his mind. At the idea, his feeling of coldness and sickness increased, complicated by helpless outrage. Why this violation? Why did they assume he would lie to them before they even spoke to him? "Did you think I was a Shing?" he asked. The face of the man on his right, lean, long-haired, bearded, sprang suddenly into the lamplight, the lips drawn back, and his open hand struck Falk across the mouth, jolting his head back and blinding him a moment with the shock. His ears rang. He tasted blood. There was a second blow, and a third. The man kept hissing many times over, "You do not say that name. Don't say it. You do not say it. You don't say it." Falk struggled helplessly to defend himself, to get free. The man on his left spoke sharply. Then there was silence for some while.
"I meant no harm coming here," Falk said at last, as steadily as he could through his anger, pain, and fear.
"All right," said the one on the left, Argerd. "Go on and tell your little story. What did you mean in coming here?"
"To ask for a night's shelter, and ask if there's any trail going west."
"Why are you going west?"
"Why do you ask? I told you in mind speech, where there's no lying. You know my mind."
"You have a strange mind.
Argaret said in his weak voice, "and strange eyes. Nobody comes here for a night's shelter or to ask the way or for anything else. Nobody comes here. When the servants of the others come here, we kill them. We kill tool men and the speaking beasts and wanderers and pigs and vermin. We don't obey the law that says it's wrong to take life, do we, Drenum?"
The bearded one grinned, showing brownish teeth.
"We are men," Argaret said. "Men, free men, killers. What are you with your half-mind and your owl's eyes? And why shouldn't we kill you? Are you a man?"
In the brief span of his memory, Falk had not met directly with cruelty or hate. The few people he had known had been, if not fearless, not ruled by fear. They had been generous and familiar. Between these two men, he knew he was defenseless as a child, and the knowledge both bewildered and enraged him. He sought some defense or evasion, and found none. All he could do was speak the truth. "I don't know what I am or where I came from. I'm going to try to find out."
"Going where?"
He looked from Argaret to the other one, Drenum. He knew they knew the answer, and that Drenum would strike again if he said it.
"Answer," the bearded one muttered, half rising and leaning forward.
"To Estoch," Falk said.
And again Drenum struck him across the face, and again he took the blow with the silent humiliation of a child punished by strangers.
"This is no good. He's not going to say anything different from what we got from him under Penton. Let him up."
"Then what?" said Drenum. "He came for a night's shelter. He can have it. Get up."
The strap that held him into the chair was loosened. He got shakily onto his feet. When he saw the door and the black downpitch of the stairs they forced him towards, he tried to resist and break free, but his muscles would not yet obey him. Drenum arm-twisted him down into a crouch and pushed him through the doorway. The door slammed shut as he turned, staggering to keep his footing on the stairs. It was dark, black dark. The door was as if sealed shut, no handle on this side, no mote or hint of light coming under it, no sound. Falk sat down on the top step and put his head down on his arms. Gradually, the weakness of his body and the confusion in his mind wore off. He raised his head, straining to see. His night vision was extraordinarily acute, a function Rania had long ago pointed out of his large-pupiled, large-irised eyes. But only flecks and blurs of after-images tormented his eyes. He could see nothing, for there was no light. He stood up and step by step felt his slow way down the narrow, unseen descent. 21 steps, 2, 3, level. Dirt. Falk went slowly forward, one hand extended, listening. Though the darkness was a kind of physical pressure, a constraint, deluding him constantly with the notion that if he only looked hard enough he would see, he had no fear of it in itself. Methodically, by pace and touch and hearing, he mapped out a part of the vast cellar he was in, the first room of a series which, to judge by echoes, seemed to go on indefinitely. He found his way directly back to the stairs, which, because he had started from them, were home base. He sat down on the lowest step this time, and sat still. He was hungry and very thirsty. They had taken his pack and left him nothing. "It's your own fault," Falk told himself bitterly, and a kind of dialogue began in his mind. "What did I do? Why did they attack me? Zov told you, trust nobody. They trust nobody, and they're right. Even someone who comes alone asking for help, with your face, your eyes, when it's obvious even at a glance that you're not a normal human being. All the same, they could have given me a drink of water," said the perhaps childish, still fearless part of his mind. "You're damned lucky they didn't kill you at sight," his intellect replied, and got no further answer. All the people of Zove's house had, of course, got accustomed to Falk's looks, and guests were rare and circumspect, so that he had never been forced into particular awareness of his physical difference from the human norm. It had seemed so much less of a difference and barrier than the amnesia and ignorance that had isolated him so long. Now, for the first time, he realized that a stranger looking into his face would not see the face of a man. The one called Drenham had been afraid of him, and had struck him because he was afraid and repelled by the alien, the monstrous, the inexplicable. It was only what Zove had tried to tell him when he had said with such grave and almost tender warning, "You must go alone. You can only go alone." There was nothing for it now but sleep. He curled up as well as he could on the bottom step, for the dirt floor was damp, and closed his eyes on the darkness. Some time later, in timelessness, he was awakened by the mice. They ran about making a faint, tiny scrabble, a zigzag scratch of sound across the black, whispering in very small voices very close to the ground, "It is wrong to take life, it is wrong to take life. Hello, hello, don't kill us, don't kill." "I will," Falk roared, and all the mice were still. It was hard to go to sleep again, or perhaps what was hard was to be sure whether he was asleep or awake. He lay and wondered whether it was day or night, how long they would leave him here, and if they meant to kill him, or use that drug again until his mind was destroyed, not merely violated. How long it took thirst to change from discomfort to torment. How one might go about catching mice in the dark without trap or bait. How long one could stay alive on a diet of raw mouse. Several times, to get a vacation from his thoughts, he went exploring again. He found a great upended vat or tun, and his heart leaped with hope, but it rang hollow. Splintered boards near the bottom scratched his hands as he groped around it. He could find no other stairs or doors in his blind explorations of the endless, unseen walls. He lost his bearings finally and could not find the stairs again. He sat on the ground in the darkness and imagined rain falling out in the forest of his lonely journeying, the gray light and the sound of rain. He spoke in his mind all he could remember of the old canon, beginning at the beginning. The way that can be gone is not the eternal way. His mouth was so dry after a while that he tried to lick the damp dirt floor for its coolness, but to the tongue it was dry dust. The mice scuttled up quite close to him sometimes, whispering. Far away down long corridors of darkness, bolts clashed and metal clanged, a bright piercing clangor of light. Light! Vague shapes and shadows, vaultings, arches, vats, beams, openings, bulked and loomed into dim reality about him. He struggled to his feet and made his way, unsteady but running, towards the light. It came from a low doorway through which, when he got close, he could see an upswell of ground, treetops, and the rosy sky of evening or morning, which dazzled his eyes like a midsummer noon. He stopped inside the door because of that dazzlement and because a motionless figure stood just outside.
"Come out," said the weak, hoarse voice of the big man, Argerd.
"Wait, I can't see yet."
"Come out and keep going. Don't even turn your head or I'll burn it off your neck."
Falk came into the doorway, then hesitated again. His thoughts in the dark served some purpose now. If they did let him go, he had thought, it would mean that they were afraid to kill him.
"Move."
He took the chance. "Not without my pack," he said, his voice faint in his dry throat.
"This is a laser."
You might as well use it. I can't get across the continent without my own gun.
Now it was Argerd who hesitated. At last, his voice going up almost into a shriek, he yelled to someone,
"Gretan! Gretan! Bring the stranger's stuff down here!"
A long pause. Falk stood in the darkness just inside the door, Argerd motionless just outside it. A boy came running down the grassy slope visible from the door, tossed Falk's pack down, and disappeared.
"Pick it up,"
Argerd ordered. Falk came out into the light and obeyed.
"Now get going."
"Wait," Falk muttered, kneeling and looking hastily through the disarrayed, unstrapped pack. "Where's my book?"
"Book?"
"The old canon. A handbook, not electronic."
"You think we'd let you leave here with that?"
Falk stared. "Don't you people recognize the canons of man when you see them? What did you take it for?"
"You don't know and won't find out what we know. And if you don't get going, I'll burn your hands off. Get up and go on. Go straight on. Get moving!"
The shrieking note was in Argerd's voice again, and Falk realized he had nearly driven him too far. As he saw the look of hate and fear in Argerd's heavy, intelligent face, the contagion of it caught him, and hastily he closed and shouldered his pack, walked past the big man, and started up the grassy rise from the door of the cellars. The light was that of evening, a little past sunset. He walked towards it. A fine, elastic strip of pure suspense seemed to connect the back of his head to the nose of the laser pistol Argerd held, stretching out as he walked on. Across a weedy lawn, across a bridge of loose planks over the river, up a path between the pastures and then between orchards. He reached the top of the ridge. There he glanced back for one moment, seeing the hidden valley as he had first seen it, full of a golden evening light, sweet and peaceful, high chimneys over the sky-reflecting river. He hastened on into the gloom of the forest, where it was already night. Thirsty and hungry, sore and downhearted, Falk saw his aimless journey through the eastern forest stretching on ahead of him with no vague hope now of a friendly hearth somewhere along the way to break the hard, wild monotony. He must not seek a road, but avoid all roads, and hide from men and their dwelling places like any wild beast. Only one thing cheered him up a bit, besides a creek to drink from and some travel ration from his pack, and that was the thought that though he had brought his trouble on himself, he had not knuckled under. He had bluffed the moral boor and the brutal man on their own ground and got away with it. That did hearten him, for he knew himself so little that all his acts were also acts of self-discovery, like those of a boy. And knowing that he lacked so much, he was glad to learn that at least he was not without courage. After drinking and eating and drinking again, he went on, in a broken moonlight that sufficed his eyes, till he had put a mile or so of broken country between himself and the House of Fear, as he thought of the place. Then, worn out, he lay down to sleep at the edge of a little glade, building no fire or shelter, lying gazing up at the moon-washed winter sky. Nothing broke the silence but now and again the soft query of a hunting owl, and this desolation seemed to him restful and blessed after the scurrying, voice-haunted, lightless prison cellar of the House of Fear. As he pushed on westward through the trees and the days, he kept no more count of one than of the other. Time went on, and he went on. The book was not the only thing he had lost. They had kept Metok's silver water flask, and a little box also of silver, of disinfectant salve. They could only have kept the book because they wanted it badly or because they took it for some kind of code or mystery. There was a period when the loss of it weighed unreasonably on him, for it seemed to him it had been his one true link with the people he had loved and trusted. And once he told himself, sitting by his fire, that next day he would turn back and find the House of Fear again and get his book. But he went on, next day. He was able to go west with compass and sun for guides, but could never have refound a certain place in the vastness of these endless hills and valleys of the forest. Not Argerd's hidden valley, not the clearing where Parth might be weaving in the winter sunlight, either. It was all behind him, lost. Maybe it was just as well that the book was gone. What would it have meant to him here, that shrewd and patient mysticism of a very ancient civilization, that quiet voice speaking from amidst forgotten wars and disasters? Mankind had outlived disaster, and he had outrun mankind. He was too far away, too much alone. He lived entirely now by hunting. That slowed his daily pace. Even when game is not gun-shy and is very plentiful, hunting is not a business one can hurry. Then one must clean and cook the game, and sit and suck the bones beside the fire, full-bellied for a while and drowsy in the winter cold, and build up a shelter of boughs and bark against the rain, and sleep, and next day go on. A book had no place here, not even that old canon of unaction. He would not have read it. He was ceasing really to think. He hunted and ate and walked and slept, silent in the forest silence, a gray shadow slipping westward through the cold wilderness. The weather was more and more often bleak, often lean feral cats, beautiful little creatures with their pied or striped fur and green eyes waited within sight of his campfire for the leavings of his meat and came forward with sly, shy fierceness to carry off the bones he tossed them. Their rodent prey was scarce now, hibernating through the cold. No beasts since the House of Fear had spoken to or bespoken him. The animals in the lovely icy lowland woods he was now crossing had never been tampered with, had never seen or scented man, perhaps. And as it fell farther and farther behind him, he saw its strangeness more clearly, that house hidden in its peaceful valley, its very foundations alive with mice that squeaked in human speech, its people revealing a great knowledge, the truth drug, and a barbaric ignorance. The enemy had been there. That the enemy had ever been here was doubtful. Nobody had ever been here. Nobody ever would be. Jays screamed in the gray branches. Frost-rimed brown leaves crackled underfoot, the leaves of hundreds of autumns. A tall stag looked at Falk across a little meadow, motionless, questioning his right to be there. "I won't shoot you. Bagged two hens this morning," Falk said. The stag stared at him with the lordly self-possession of the speechless and walked slowly off. Nothing feared Falk here. Nothing spoke to him. He thought that in the end he might forget speech again and become as he had been, dumb, wild, unhuman. He had gone too far away from men and had come where the dumb creatures ruled and men had never come. At the meadow's edge he stumbled over a stone, and on hands and knees, read weather-worn letters carved in the half-buried block, CKO. Men had come here, had lived here, under his feet, under the icy, hummocky terrain of leafless bush and naked tree, under the roots, there was a city. Only he had come to the city a millennium or two too late.